funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are blue laws blue while a green card is white and a modern-day white shoe law firm populated by professionals highly unlikely to show up in footwear that is anything but brown or black? Given the everyday presence of the legal system in our lives, it's not surprising that so many expressions have made their way from courtrooms to living rooms. But if you think about it for a while, you may realize that we use many law-related phrases all the time without having any idea why we use them. Elizabeth G. Thornburg is professor at the Dedman School of Law at SMU, which, in the interest of full disclosure, is a sponsor of this program. She teaches and writes about civil procedure and legal metaphors. And with James Clapp, Mark Galanter, and Fred Shapiro, she is co-author of the new book Law Talk, The Unknown Stories Behind Familiar Legal Expressions. Beth, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this book is the brainchild of your co-author. And is it Galanter, Galanter?
It's Galanter.
Okay.
You got it right.
How did he recruit you to take part?
Well, I happened to be at a conference in Chicago where he was, and he knew that I was interested in the way law uses language and also in the way culture and law interact with each other. And he and the other two authors had been working on the book for a while, but it just turned into a huge project. So he asked me if I would be interested in coming on as the fourth author. And since I just love this area, I said yes immediately.
Was it hard to divide up who would take what expression?
A little bit. They already had a pretty long list. And so what we did is sort of email each other, I'd be interested in this one, I'd be interested in that one. And it actually divided up quite nicely so that there were only a couple that we sort of did the email version of flipping coins for.
I think it's interesting, and it says this in the book, that a lot of lawyers will use these expressions without necessarily knowing where they came from. And in some cases, they think they know where they came from, and they're actually wrong. And rule of thumb is a great example of this.
Yes, even lawyers are fooled by this. Mm-hmm. There is a normal English expression, rule of thumb, just mm-hmm. about a rough estimate based on experience, going back to people using their thumb as a measure of an inch. Mm-hmm. But the legend is that there was once actually a rule of thumb that men were allowed to beat their wives as long as they didn't use a stick that was any bigger around than their thumb. And that's not true, probably never been true. Possibly before the 1660s, there was a husband's right of what they called moderate correction. But that's, it's long, long gone before they were U.S. colonies. The legend may come from a story from the late 1700s. There was a judge named Buller, and it was reported, so the media comes in here too.
It's always our fault.
That's right. Not the lawyers. There was a rumor that he had issued a decree, that he had ruled in a case that the husband was allowed to beat his wife because he had used a stick not bigger around than the thumb. Probably he never said that, but even if he had, it was so outrageous, even at the time, that he became the butt of jokes. So they did political cartoons about him where he was called Judge Thumb. So this is like the equivalent today of somebody doing something so silly or outrageous that instantly Leno and Letterman and Conan would be making jokes about it. The Daily Show would have a thing. So no, there never has been, or at least not within for hundreds of years, such a rule of thumb. But as people became more aware of the problem of domestic violence, people picked up on that, speculated about it. And you know how it goes with the internet. Things get repeated over and over and over again. And if it's on 15 websites, it must be true.
Yeah. And in fact, there's research that the more often you see something, right or wrong, the more likely you are to believe it.
Absolutely. So this got repeated a lot. And it's not true. And I think it is true that even though it has been illegal, sadly, it has been true for hundreds of years that people beat their partners. And it's important to work against that. But it doesn't help to spread a story that's not true. And in fact, it suggests that if only the law were different, then the problem would go away, whereas actually it's persisted for hundreds of years despite the fact that it was illegal.
Let's talk about immigration law. First of all, why is a green card not green?
Oh, green card is probably my very favorite entry in the book. A green card was green at one point, but the word green card, the phrase green card, does not originally come from English. Hmm. It was a Spanish-speaking population's term description for when the card was green, you know, tarjeta verde. It came into English, we think, starting in 1962. There was this this wonderful reporter for the LA Times named Ruben Salazar, who actually grew up in El Paso, so there's a Texas tie. And he became so so famous and important that there's a stamp with his picture on it. But anyway, he was doing a series of stories about the problems of migrant farm workers in Southern California, and he interviewed them. And in the story that he wrote about what he learned, he would quote them in Spanish and then in English. So somebody was talking about having a tarjeta verde, and he said green card. And he started using it in his stories, and then other media picked it up. But this was in 1962. In 1964, the card changed to blue. So it was catching on in English just as it wasn't an accurate description of the card anymore. But then the story goes on, and in some ways it's as much fun to me as the other part. I studied Spanish when I was growing up in school, but it's been a long time, so I've been trying to get it back. And one of the things that I've done is subscribe to Al Día, the Spanish language newspaper, which everyone should do to practice their Spanish, and it gets delivered free to your home Wednesdays and Saturdays. So I was reading Al Día one day as I was drinking my coffee, and there was a story about immigration law, and it was Spanish, 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 green card. Spanish, Spanish, Spanish. So I thought, oh my gosh, it's turning into Spanglish, I guess, would be the lay term. The technical term would be code switching. So I contacted some editors at Al Día and asked if green card is what they use. And the answer was, yeah, we think that that term is more generally used and understood. And if we were going to say something in Spanish, we'd probably say tarjeta de residencia, which would be the more accurate description. So it went from Spanish to English as what we call a loan translation. They actually translate card and green back into Spanish as code switching. And we've now found it even in newspapers in Mexico, where it'll be speaking Spanish and then say green card and then more Spanish. So it's green, although it's not green because it was once green, and the name stuck.
I love how that goes back and forth. In the same way that we have a word like rodeo, and we don't think of it as being a Spanish word, but in fact it is.
That's right. And actually, loan translations are kind of unusual in English because English so readily absorbs words from other languages. Mm-hmm. So to take one that's very much like green card, we say carte blanche, which is white card in French, but we don't translate that one white card. So I think that's more evidence of Salazar being the source of the change from Spanish to English.
So another immigration-related phrase that comes up in the book is wet foot, dry foot. And of course, poor Herman Cain, whether you like him or not, he's had a lot of trouble lately. And not too long ago, he was in trouble for not knowing what this meant. And in fact, it refers to the policy that the Immigration Service has. If Cuban refugees are caught at sea, they're sent back to Cuba. And if they make it to dry land, they're allowed to stay.
Yes, that's right. And I don't think that was ever created as an intentional policy. When Castro first took over, we had the first bunch of refugees from Cuba. And when it became clear they couldn't go back, Congress passed this thing called the Cuban Adjustment Act, which essentially kind of gives them automatic asylum. Mm-hmm. It's a little more complicated than that, but that works for now. And lots of people from Cuba came, and they would set off in rickety boats and be rescued at sea and get asylum. And perhaps that was taken advantage of when 125,000 people arrived within 6 months in South Florida. So during the Clinton administration, they negotiated a different deal. So if people were stopped at sea, they'd be sent back or perhaps given asylum elsewhere if they could qualify. So that created some odd things, and it came to a head when there was this incident in Miami where some people who were trying to come from Cuba almost made it to shore, and the Coast Guard was trying really, really hard to keep them from landing, you know, with water guns and things. And the Miami media covered it a lot, of course. And one reporter was interviewing the assistant bureau chief of the Border Patrol at the time. And we don't know what question he asked him, but we imagine it was something like, why didn't you just let him come to land and then arrest him? Why all this drama out in the water? And in order to explain that odd combination of at sea you go back, on land you get asylum, the border chief had young kids, and they apparently visited him in his office. And so, as a lot of us who have our kids come to work do, he had some toys for his kids in his office. And amazingly, one of the things that he had was this box of Dr. Seuss flashcards, wet foot, dry foot, low foot, high foot. And struggling to explain this kind of odd policy to the reporter, he said, oh, it's like Dr. Seuss. Wet foot, dry foot. You know, wet foot you go back, dry foot you stay. And the policy has some very bizarre consequences. So if there's 30 people in a boat and 15 of them jump out and know how to swim and make it to shore, they get asylum. And if 15 more don't and are swimming, they don't. One case involved some people who had made it as far as an old bridge south of Marathon Key in Florida. Hmm. But the bridge was so old that it had gaps in it. So what do you think is that? If you've got to go back, you're dry, but you've got to go back in the water to get all the way to shore. Is that wet foot? Go back. Or is that dry foot? No, you get to stay. And that's an example of how hard it is to predict, because initially the immigration people said, well, no, that's wet. You know, you're dry now, but you can't get to land without getting wet again. And then a judge disagreed and said, no, they get to come back.
That is very, very complicated, even more complicated than explaining the phrase.
Yeah, it is. And, of course, the part I love about it is it's Dr. Seuss. Mm-hmm. My parents read me Dr. Seuss books when I was a little girl. So, you know, I was all about If I Ran the Zoo and Green Eggs and Ham. And then we read Dr. Seuss to our daughter when she was little. And the idea that that can be the source of a quite serious legal doctrine is a lot of fun, and shows that the law does have a sense of humor sometimes.
So, Beth, I will never forget moving to Texas from New York when I was a teenager, and I had never heard of these things called blue laws, which said that if I were going to the store for my mom, I could buy a carton of eggs, but I couldn't buy a whisk. Blue laws, I guess they're gone now in Texas, except with regard to alcohol sales in some cases. But this basically was a series of things that said you couldn't buy certain things on Sundays. Is that right?
You couldn't do a lot of things on Sundays. Mm-hmm. And initially, it would have referred to lots of kinds of government laws that limited various activities based on usually religious grounds. And the term blue laws originated in the American colonies, we think. And it was often the Church of England Anglicans who were more flexible about when one can do, making fun of the Puritans and the Puritans making fun of the Anglicans. But it was really popularized by this this minister named Samuel Peters, who was Anglican, very, very high church, very, I wish I were in England, I dress like a squire, and very vocal about it. So he had a lot of conflicts with the Sons of Liberty sort of during the American Revolutionary period and eventually fled to England with his slaves. So he was an important, relatively well-off guy in New York. But then he gets to England and he's an immigrant and doesn't have a lot of money. So, and he's mad. So what better way to take care of all of his problems than to write this book, which he called The General History of Connecticut, to make fun of the people who he saw as having been the source of his problems. So he made fun of a lot of things. And I grew up in Connecticut, so I don't, of course, take this personally, but I think it's interesting. should I wait until after
Yes,
the break?
We'll find out why blue in just a couple
okay.
of minutes. My guest is Elizabeth G. Thornburg. She's professor at the Dedman School of Law at SMU and a co-author of the new book Law Talk, The Unknown Stories Behind Familiar Legal Expressions. If you've got a question, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Elizabeth G. Thornburg is my guest. She's professor at the Dedman School of Law at SMU and co-author of the new book Law Talk, The Unknown Stories Behind Familiar Legal Expressions. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Beth, we have this great story of the history of Connecticut and of the battle between Protestants Anglicans and Puritans, but why blue for the blue laws?
That's a great question, and we're not positive. But Peters himself, the guy who made up these stories and also made up stories like invasions of frogs and people leaving their beds naked in the middle of the night, Peters said it was blue laws like bloody laws. And so kind of like, you know, bloody blue. So it was kind of slightly naughty. Mm-hmm. Most of the stories that are circulating about what it means are not true. So first of all, not laws. And so the most common explanation is that they were printed on blue paper. But that's not true. Hmm. Peters himself said that they were never printed. And blue paper would have been so expensive and rare in the Connecticut colonies back then that it wouldn't make sense even if he hadn't said that. But he was, again, trying to make fun of him. So he said that there were laws like no woman can kiss her child on the Sabbath or that men in some kind of colonial mullet kind of thing had to have their hair cut around like a cap. So we think blue as sort of a version of bloody. And it was religious at first, but then when that became legally untenable, they said, well, no, it's just for a day of rest. And it turned into mostly just Sunday closing laws. Mm-hmm. But people sometimes didn't want rest so much as recreation on Sundays. And for working people who worked 6 days a week at the time, Sunday was their chance to do their own errands and things like that. So gradually, as it became less and less popular, states would create exceptions. And so, well, you can buy diapers or you can buy the newspaper. So it's like the example you gave. Go to the store for your mom and you can get things. So it's still the reason that we can't buy beer before noon if we want to drink it while we watch a Cowboys game. And I think perhaps in Texas you still can't sell cars on Sundays, but I'm not positive about that. But they are mostly gone. But there are some proposals on ballots in various places to bring parts of them back or places that still have remnants like Texas does to get rid of the last little bit so that we have nothing to stand in the way of us and the shopping mall.
And our commerce.
That's right.
Try and stop us.
That's right. Professional football, shopping malls, untouchable.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go quickly here to Jordan in Fort Worth. Hey, Jordan.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
I was calling because you had commented on the blue cards, green cards conversation, and you'd said that there weren't any green cards anymore. And I'm actually a British citizen who just got his green card, or my green card, I guess, in May, and mine is actually green.
Huh.
That's really fascinating. Jordan, is it completely green, or is it just a little green stripe on the back? Because the last time I looked at one, it was that, so it'll be really interesting if it's green again.
Yeah, the majority of it is either fully green or it's got like green shading. So it's either like a pale green. But I was surprised too because I didn't think that they were green anymore either until I got it. And then I was like, oh, it is green.
Well, thank you for that update. That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's really good to know. You know, they've embedded all sorts of security devices in them too. And so changing the color is one of the things that they do to try to make it harder to counterfeit them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Paul, who writes he is unindicted in Terrell, says, in news stories, both print and broadcast, grand juries are said to hand down indictments, except that sometimes the story says the grand jury handed up an indictment. Is there a difference?
I think legally, no, there's not a difference. But that's really interesting. Up versus down, handed down, indicted, handed up. And I think handed down is probably more common. And I don't actually know what the directional origin of that is.
It's funny to say hand down because you would hand it to the presiding judge, I would think, right?
To the district attorney.
Yeah, to the DA, and then the DA then moves forward with the case.
Yeah. And sometimes they would say that it issues an indictment. So the verbs that are attached to legal things are fascinating, and I have not researched that one, so I don't know, but that's a good question. And, of course, grand jury is from the French grand, so it really just means big jury. And the juries that we just call juries are technically petty juries, which would be little jury. But it sounds like something your grandmother would tell you. This is the big jury and that's the little jury. And so
and there are more people on a grand jury, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's usually about somewhere between 16 and 23.
Mm-hmm. And what's all this about indicting a ham sandwich?
Oh, OK. I love this. Well, of course, grand juries originally way back in England were sort of had a roving commission to ferret out crime. And at that time, way, way back, once they accused somebody, they would have been tried by being thrown in the water to see whether they float or sink. But there was a period where they had a certain amount of independence and could be a sort of bulwark of people's rights. And for example, a grand jury in Massachusetts refused to indict the people who were accused of having been the ones who threw the tea in the harbor for the Boston Tea Party. So it became enshrined as a right in the U.S. Constitution. But today, the prosecutor has so much control over what information is given to the grand jury that except in a really, really unusual circumstance, the grand jury tends to do what the prosecutor wants. And in fact, if one grand jury doesn't, they can try again with the new grand jury.
And I would imagine, let me interrupt you for a second, most prosecutors are aware of the cases that would work or not, right? I mean, they would decline to prosecute a case that they didn't think they could get an indictment on.
Yeah, that's right. Unless they wanted as political cover to be able to say, well, the grand jury wouldn't do it. But for example, they decide it's not a trial. It's here's the evidence on my side. So a lot of states have actually stopped using grand juries and use a sort of a preliminary hearing instead. Sometimes if you look at old Perry Mason episodes, that was actually a preliminary hearing to decide whether charges would be brought against his client. So there are reform movements that suggest that would be a better protection than the grand jury. So in 1984, a man named Saul Wachtler, who at that time was the chief judge of New York's highest court, was giving an interview to the New York Daily News, and he was a proponent of getting rid of grand juries. And he said that a district attorney has so much influence on a grand jury that by and large they could get them to indict a ham sandwich. He later told a reporter that since he was Jewish, he wished he had said indict a corned beef sandwich. But what was done was done. And that was kind of catchy and it's caught on. So, for example, if you're a fan of TV crime shows and listen to especially Law and Order, it'll sneak on there once in a while. And if you haven't heard this expression, you think, what? And so sometimes the defense attorney will say something like, so did you indict my client before or after the ham sandwich? That's what they're talking about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sally in Dallas. Hey, Sally.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This discussion is really fascinating. I particularly like the story about wet foot, dry foot, and how that had its origin in Dr. Seuss.
Mm-hmm.
And got me thinking about sort of children's stories in general. And I was thinking of this phrase that sounds like it might have come out of a children's story, and that's kangaroo court. What is the origin of that particular term?
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Sally. That's a great question, and it's that would be a wonderful guess. But it turns out that's probably not where kangaroo court saying comes from, but it does have this wonderful Texas tie. In the 1830s, people who worked in the cattle business had these sort of informal trials that were, you know, part enforcement, part entertainment. And the kangaroo had only sort of recently been discovered by people outside of Australia. So it's kind of a funny animal and it jumps around. And you can make up any explanation you want for why kangaroo courts, but they were also at that time called Mustang courts. So it may be because it's the sort of powerful, unpredictable animal. We don't know. But sometimes it was the ranchers enforcing their rules against the cowboys or the cowboys against each other. There's a story about one cowboy saying that they used it to stop smutty stories around the campfire. A lot of times it was used just to haze newcomers. But it spread from Texas with that name, Kangaroo Court, and sometimes with the judge being called to the kangaroo. It spread north and east. And the thing about the kangaroo courts was that the person who was accused always lost. It became somewhat more sinister when it got more institutionalized so that county jails would have kangaroo courts. So the new prisoner would be accused of something bogus and they would use it as a way to put him on trial and take whatever cash he might have with him. And sometimes worse than that, sometimes beatings, because there are cases about people getting damages for being severely beaten by a kangaroo court. And then eventually it spread to language generally as an insult to any kind of court that's regarded as completely unfair, and particularly as the person is going to be convicted whether they're innocent or not and whatever the evidence might be. So I love the idea that it might be a kangaroo court. I sort of picture Kanga and Roo and A.A. Milne, but we're pretty sure it's the animal and it came from these cowboy courts rather from a children's story.
I'm going to assume that as a professor at the SMU Law School, you were glad that Mustang Court did not catch on in the same way.
Yeah.
Do something to the credibility of the degrees you're giving out.
Yeah, we would want a Mustang law degree or a kangaroo law degree for that matter.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Gail in Dallas. Hey, Gail.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I wonder, in reading popular novels like by Grisham and Conley, I come across the term white shoe law firms, which doesn't make any sense because I can't imagine lawyers wearing white shoes.
Let's get the answer for you.
Thanks, Gail. That's a great question. And this is an example of something in the law that comes from popular culture that is a bit dated. So it does mean sort of an old line, upper crust law firm. And it started to get used for law firms sort of in the 1950s and 60s. So think about white buckskin shoes. That was a typical part of the socially elite Ivy League kids student attire. And there was an article in Esquire in 1953 talking about it, and it centered on Yale, where it became sort of part of student lingo. So instead of saying chic, they would say shoe. Hmm. So a person who was very cool would be terribly shoe, or you could have a shoe fraternity. And what Esquire said was that white shoe applies primarily to socially ambitious and socially smug types. Well, that's in some ways not the smug part, perhaps, but that's just who those big Wall Street firms wanted to recruit: white, Protestant, male, in the upper levels of the social register. So they were perfect fodder for law firm hiring. And as those college boys became lawyers and law partners, we think that the language kind of migrated with them. So they started to talk about their firms as white shoe firms, probably kind of in-crowd jargon until maybe the 1980s. People didn't. Law firms were not much in the news until recently, until they could start advertising, until it became more like a business. So in the 1980s, you start to see white shoe firm more often in media descriptions of law firms, which ironically is just as they were starting to not be quite so white shoe.
They were diversifying.
That's right. They're mm-hmm. hiring more women, people who are not Protestants, people of color, although some people say that they're still white shoe at heart, even if the people don't match that description, the attitudes do. But now it's really more about it's got a prominent background and it's a very powerful, well-connected firm.
And no firm would call itself white shoe, I would imagine, because that also implies very expensive. Am I correct about that?
Yes, the firm would not at least officially advertise it. You wouldn't see, like, you know, Smith & Jones website saying,
your neighborhood white shoe law firm. Right,
right. Right. And sometimes it's also applied to, like, investment bankers and things like that as well. So they may like it internally, but it would not be the head of their PR campaign.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I have to ask you about this. Everybody in this country knows that Ben Franklin coined the term death and taxes, except that he didn't coin the term death and taxes.
Yeah, that's right. And that was one of the things that surprised me. I thought he coined death and taxes because he coined so many things, mm-hmm. right? He did use the expression in a letter to a friend shortly before he died. You know, in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. And he was really so beloved that a lot of his things were published after he died, including this letter. But people started attributing it to him along with his other things. But it turns out it was old. He never claimed to have coined it, and he would be amazed to think that he was being given credit for it. So, for example, there's a book of aphorisms, of sayings, that was published 30 years before he wrote that letter. Hmm. And it sort of combined a couple of things that we say now. Many things happen between the cup and the lip, or nothing is certain but death and taxes. Hmm. So that's 30 years. And then looking even farther back, there was a play written 40 years before that, so 70 years before Franklin wrote this letter. And there was this dialogue between a husband and wife, and the wife was about to say that she was sure of something. And the husband says, "You lie. You are not sure. For I say, woman, it is impossible to be sure of anything but death and taxes." So not Franklin. And maybe this these days with really good legal advice, not even taxes.
So. So Franklin would never have dreamed of taking credit for an expression that he did not originate. However, Frank Luntz, who has been on the show, who has talked to us about the phrase death tax and not corrected our introduction of him as the man who pioneered this phrase, in fact, is not the first one to come up with it.
Did he really? No, he's not. I mean, he's certainly the one who promoted it most energetically and successfully. But the phrase death tax has been around for a really long time, including Andrew Carnegie, who grew up as a poor boy in Scotland and came to the United States and made a fortune, who advocated taxes on the transfer of wealth at death, called them death taxes. But it is a great example of a politically promoted, created phrase, because it is actually better known, or not better known maybe these days, but more accurately called an estate tax. And after the break, I'll tell you more about how they made it so popular and what that did.
Elizabeth G. Thornburg is my guest. She's professor at the Dedman School of Law at SMU and a co-author of the new book, Law Talk, The Unknown Stories Behind Familiar Legal Expressions. We'll get the answer to that question and answer more of your calls at 1-800-933-5372 after the break.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Elizabeth G. Thornburg. She is professor at the Dedman School of Law at SMU and author of the new book, Law Talk, The Unknown Stories Behind Familiar Legal Expressions. And Beth, before the break, you were talking about death tax.
Right. I was saying that that it's a great example of political people understanding the power of language. As recently as the Contract with America, the estate tax was thought of as almost politically unassailable. So they talked about raising the amount, but even they didn't talk about getting rid of it. But starting in the early 2000s, people thought, this will work. So, for example, Grover Nordquist, who is a well-known anti-tax campaigner, said, the problem is calling it estate tax. Estates are what British people hunt foxes on. Hmm. Death is something everybody does.
Yeah.
And in fact, Frank Luntz was very instrumental with focus groups and other things of getting people to say death tax. So that by 2003, 49% of Americans believed that most families have to pay this tax. It's something you pay at death. Whereas, in fact, 2010, the most recent year there's numbers for, 0.3% of 1% of of estates were subject to the estate tax. So this is not even like the 99% and the 1%. This is, I mean, it's wealth and not income, but it's 0.3%. And on top of people believing that they would have to pay it, Luntz in testing it also discovered that once people had acquired that idea, that even getting information that showed it was not true was not apt to dislodge that belief from their heads. So politically, this coining of death tax and doing things like having press conferences at mortuaries or having people dressed like the Grim Reaper standing in front of Congress has been incredibly powerful in affecting how people think about it. There are real death taxes. In Britain, for example, they're just about to, I think, or they're talking about adopting a tax on death certificates. And you die, you need a death certificate for something, you pay the tax. That's a death tax. This is a tax on wealth transfer. And in 2011, it's only going to apply to individual estates of $5 million or for married couples, $10 million. So that's why it only affects a tiny, tiny, tiny percent of Americans.
We should be so lucky as to have to pay the death tax or whatever you want to call it.
That's right.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Laura calling from Dallas. Hello, Laura.
Hello. Fascinating show. I'm really enjoying it.
Good.
The question that I had is, I was one of the many baby boomer addicts of Law & Order, the original season. And one term I used to hear all the time on that show and probably on other shows as well was the term fishing expedition. And I think I've intuited what it means more or less, but I would be curious to know what the origin of that expression is and what it really does mean.
Well, Laura, you've come to the right place. This is in the book, and then Beth is ready to tell us.
Thanks for asking, Laura. Of course, you knew from watching TV and just from being a smart person that it's not really about fishing, like no fishing rod, no reel, no net. It's an accusation that some kind of investigation is way too wide-ranging and unjustified, or in civil cases that people are trying to use the court's discovery powers too broadly. I got interested in this term because I was doing research for the stuff I normally teach at SMU, and I kept finding these cases saying, you know, you can't go on a fishing expedition. And I found them in Scotland, and I found them in Canada, and I found them in Australia. And there was a Texas Supreme Court case several years ago that said, well, you can fish using this device but not using that device. And I thought, what is up with this? So I decided it was worth researching and started looking at the cases, and it is everywhere. And once you start listening for it, it's on the news, it's on Law and Order, it's on all sorts of things. I was doing research for my original article visiting my parents one time, and they knew what I was doing, and I went back home, and my mother would call and say, fishing expedition, they said fishing expedition on TV. If you look at old English cases, the oldest one, the oldest civil case that I've been able to find was in 1752. So this has been around for a really long time. And when they were talking about it in civil cases at that time, it was about trying to limit disclosure of private information about property ownership. So it would be about bastard children and ugly fights between second wives and children from a first marriage. Now it's evolved in civil cases to be more about protecting companies from the expense of litigation, especially as defendants, and especially in cases that are unpopular in certain circles, sort of little guy against big company. So stock fraud claims or civil rights claims, product liability claims. And we sort of forget because it's so omnipresent that it's actually a metaphor. And one of the things that I love that I found doing this research are quotes from cases where you can tell that even the judges who ought to know better forget that fishing expedition is just a metaphor. So they write sentences like, the trial court should not allow plaintiffs to embark on a wide-ranging fishing expedition in hopes that there may be gold out there somewhere. Or the trial court cannot be faulted for slamming the door on this transparent fishing expedition.
Boy, this is like every metaphor crime you can possibly commit.
Yeah. And one more. This allows a product liability plaintiff to go on a fishing expedition in the defendant's records in the mere hope of finding a smoking gun. So I can't quite picture how the gun and the rod and the reel all together. So we forget that it's just a metaphor, and it doesn't really have any exact legal meaning. It's just name-calling. So my argument, which of course is fruitless, is that it's had its 15 minutes. It's been around since 1752. It is time to let it go.
So now that I have four kids, the phrase "Read the Riot Act" comes to mind more often than it ever did before. And I have to tell you, reading about the origins, it makes me feel so guilty for ever reading my kids the Riot Act, because this was sort of violent in its early history.
Yeah, there really was a Riot Act passed in England. And it was really to try to keep order and suppress people who were trying to bring back the Stuart kings. You know, James, Charles, James, William and Mary came and took over. People were trying to put the Scottish kings back on the throne. So to try to keep people from assembling to do that, they passed this act, which had a funny long name, but we nickname it the Riot Act. And in fact, there was a death penalty for violations of this act. When a group of 12 or more persons were unlawfully, riotously, and tumultuously assembled together. But there was sort of, in warning your kids, you know, mm-hmm. do that again and time out, you are giving them the same kind of fair notice that that the original Riot Act in 1715 included, because the act required the public person to warn the people who were assembled. So back in those days, they said, you would say, "Our sovereign lord the king chargeth and commandeth all persons," etc., "immediately to disperse themselves and peaceably to depart to their habitations."
Go to your room.
that's right. Go to your room. Go to your room. Shut up. And they couldn't be prosecuted unless they were still hanging around an hour after the warning was read. Mm-hmm. So you probably don't want to give your kids an hour.
They don't have an hour.
No. But giving them a warning and reading the Riot Act is in some ways very much like what was going on in 18th century England.
Where do we get the word scofflaw?
Scofflaw is great. Scofflaw was the winner of a contest.
We don't get many words this way.
No. It sounds kind of Shakespearean.
It does.
Scofflaw or biblical. There was this wealthy guy in Massachusetts who was very much a proponent of the Prohibition laws, and his name was Delsevere King. And his idea was that to try to get at the hypocrisy of people who would sort of give lip service to the Prohibition laws but actually go home and have a martini, you needed to have something that would make fun of them. And so he actually sponsored a contest where he promised $100 in gold and then later increased to $200 in gold for the person who would make up a word. And he compared it to scab that was used to criticize people who were crossing labor picket lines and mm-hmm. things. If you get a word for people who disregarded the liquor laws the same way as scab, then it would work. And so he had this contest, and they had 5,000 letters containing 20,000 suggestions from every state. Now, he asked for a word that would characterize a lawless, scoffing drinker. And scofflaw won. So we think it's actually possible that he made up the word himself, but we don't know that. But here's some of the other terms. See if you like these better. Boozhevik or lawjacker or patronaut. But scofflaw won, and it's very catchy. So it hung around, although it was made fun of almost immediately. So a guy who was at the time a sports reporter named Westbrook Pegler later became a fairly well-known columnist. He said, "Scofflaw, the terrible epithet crackled above the clank of bottles, decanters, and glasses in all well-ordered speakeasies like the awesome thunder of rose petals in a June breeze."
Here's some purple prose if ever you've desired any.
That's right. And there was a competing contest almost immediately for a word that would describe people in the words of the contest sponsor. The best coined word that will in effect mean one who scoffs at the God-given privileges of liberty and the pursuit of happiness.
And did they get a winning word?
They did. Let me tell you the finalists, and you can or the listeners can decide which one they think should have won. So Kilwright, Metal Bug, Poke Nose, Dictomaniac, Spigot Bigot. But the one that won was actually Ban Bug.
And that went nowhere.
That went nowhere. And scoff law, since it was really associated with Prohibition, kind of disappeared for a while. But the New York Times revived it in connection with people who didn't pay parking tickets and ignored traffic laws in the 70s. And then that kind of died out. And now it seems to be making a comeback to refer to people who illegally download movies and music from the internet. So I think whenever there's a law that a big chunk of the public disagrees with to the extent that they're going to kind of disregard it and maybe even make fun of it, scoff law may make yet another comeback.
Yeah, I didn't know before looking at this book that there was an association with Prohibition at all. I think of it mostly in the parking ticket sense, but I suppose I should update that to think about illegal downloads. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Greg in Dallas. Hey, Greg.
Hello. Were there any terms that particularly surprised you when you researched their meanings or which you think are today widely misunderstood?
Thanks, Greg. That's a great question. I think that there are a lot that are misunderstood. Green card certainly was that I talked about earlier was one of the ones that surprised me. I learned a new term researching the term rap sheet. So rap, which just started out as a word that sounds like what it is, you know, like rap on
knocking,
right, had evolved to mean take the blame, and then sort of the early 20th century mobsters had made it part of the lingo. So beat the rap, take the rap, bum rap. And all that was really well established in English before people started talking about rap sheets. Rap sheet being sort of a list of your criminal charges. And that became more known more middle to later 20th century. But because that whole world of crime and enforcement, all that is just full of things with initials, so like FBI, and acronyms, like a pronounceable batch of initials, somebody must have thought, well, RAP must be the initials. It must stand for something. And so they said, oh, well, clearly RAP sheet stands for Record of Arrests and Prosecutions, which is not true. The word RAP was already there. So what the new thing that I learned, I knew about acronyms, but what I had never heard of before is this idea of a backronym. It's sort of a made-up story where the word came before the expression. So a real acronym is something like SCUBA, you know, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. A false one would be something like saying that the word golf comes from gentlemen only, ladies forbidden, or that cop comes from constable on patrol. I mean, they're all sort of plausible and fun, but not true. They are backronyms. So saying that rap sheet is Record of Arrest and Prosecution is a backronym. If you want to play with backronyms, people have created backronym generators on the internet. So just put that in Google and you can make up a backronym for your own name if you want to.
Elizabeth Thornburg is professor at the Dedman School of Law at SMU and a co-author of the new book Law Talk, The Unknown Stories Behind Familiar Legal Expressions. Beth, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.